Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne in Wiltshire, which is soaking wet. It's been raining almost non-stop for the last 3 days.
Oh, good. Hello, it's Richard Heller in southeast London. It's cloudy over here, but I can't wait for the wet weather to arrive from Wiltshire. May I just say, first of all, since we're recording on July the 8th, may I say, first of all, happy birthday to Sourav Ganguly, who's 49 today. And this today is the 60th anniversary of a great performance by Fred Truman, in which he took 5 wickets at no cost at all, bowling off cutters in the Headingley Test match against Australia, an Ashes Test, which England won, thanks to him.
Now, we have a very learned guest today who has written an absolutely mind-blowing book about a hitherto almost unknown subject, Richard.
Well, we certainly have. It's a great pleasure and honour to welcome Raf Nicholson to the podcast. Raf has been writing about commenting on analysing women's cricket for quite a few years now. She's also an executive member of the Cricket Society, but she's written, as you say, a comprehensive and authoritative history of women's cricket in Britain called Ladies and Lords. It's been a joy to read, and we're going to talk about it today. And Raf, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you so much for the kind words about the book. It's so nice to think that people are reading it and enjoying it and learning something from it, I suppose.
Well, certainly learning from it, Raf. But one of the first things I learned from it, from your introduction, is how rare it is. Really struck by the scarcity of literature on English women's cricket and English women's sport generally. It seems to me that women's sport gets a sort of double neglect. It gets neglected by male historians of sport, but it also seems to get neglected by feminist historians as well, and historians of the women's movements. Why? I can understand sort of male chauvinism and enduring prejudice for the neglect by male historians, but why do you think women have been so reluctant to write about women and leisure?
I think there was in the 1970s, and with the onset of second wave feminism in the UK, there was a bit of a feeling that sport was a male domain and something that men did and something that men kind of enjoyed in their spare time. And that from women's perspective, therefore, some feminists kind of rejected it on the grounds that they felt that it almost that sport wasn't something that they could be involved in, that it was something that men did, I suppose. So there's a kind of sort of almost an ideological rejection of sport and cricket on the grounds that it is a very kind of blokey activity, I suppose. And certainly some of the big movers and shakers in second wave feminism in the UK seem to have not had a very positive experience of sport at school, for example.
Yes, that may be a life experience. Maybe that may last a lifetime. I don't know. It'd be interesting to analyse how many were compelled to play team sports, particularly cricket.
Sheila Rowbottom, who was one of the big kind of early second wave feminists in the UK, talks about hiding in the cupboard or something during games lessons at her elite girls' public school. And so she would certainly have been one of those who wouldn't have appreciated sport and cricket in particular.
Now, it does strike me, actually, reading your book, Raf, it reminds me rather of our conversation 2 weeks ago with the great South African historian of black cricket, André Odendaal, who says that when he was at Cambridge and decided to set eyes on what became his life's work, he was advised not to examine black cricket simply because he was told there would be no records, that, you know, nobody would have written about it. And then he described very movingly going into the archives and discovering the black press and discovering there was an immense amount on the subject. But there was a complete vacuum of coverage, of course, in the dominant ruling class white press.
I think it is similar in women's cricket. I think when I set out, because the book is basically the book of my PhD thesis, which looked at the history of women's cricket. And so I spent many years doing the research for that. But when I first started out researching women's cricket, I did think that I was going to have to be very reliant on actually doing oral histories and interviewing women players. And while I did end up doing some of that, I discovered that there was a huge amount of material. It's just that it hadn't at that point been deposited anywhere, hadn't been kind of properly archived. And so I did make some really exciting discoveries. I remember discovering that the Women's Cricket Association, who'd been the governing body of women's cricket between 1926 and 1998, when the ECB took over, they had actually their own kind of collected documents. And at the time that I discovered them, they were in this this kind of glorified cow shed in a very remote corner of Lancashire. They'd been put there because one of the former England women players had retired and she'd gone on and married a farmer, and they had the space for these documents. So I basically went and lived in her shed for a couple of weeks during my PhD and found these kind of amazing documents, you know, minutes and photographs and letters and press cuttings, all about this amazingly exciting period of history that hadn't really been kind of discovered by anyone, because nobody had bothered to look, in a way. And so that was really exciting. And I can now say, if anyone's getting a little bit nervous about these historical documents being in a cow shed, they are now at Lord's, and they were deposited there quite recently. So that's great for future researchers, but I did really have to do a little bit of digging, yes.
Gosh, but they might not have ended up. They might still be in the cow shed, is that what you're saying, Ralph? But for you, or you know, nobody in authority knew about these precious documents for years, did they?
Yeah, exactly. I think that there were people, kind of former women's cricketers, sort of pushing, and they had an interim stop at Taunton. At the Somerset Cricket Museum. So they were there for a little while, and now they have been acquired by Lord's. So I wouldn't say I was necessarily the person that was pushing the process, but I think that hopefully what the book did and what my work has done is kind of shed a little bit more light onto this period of history and this subject that really there hadn't been a huge amount or really very much at all written about before.
Now, I think we ought to know who the name of the women's cricketer who saved those documents, because if it hadn't been for her, sounds like it wouldn't have been for her enterprise, maybe all those documents would have been lost. Well, who was she? Tell us a bit about her.
Her name's Carol Hodges, although her married name is Carol Cornthwaite. So when she was playing for England, all of her cricket records will be under Carol Hodges. She did captain England for a while in the late 1980s, and she was famously a member of England's World Cup winning side in 1993. They won the World Cup at home in England, and the final was played at Lord's, and she hit a century against Australia very memorably in a kind of must-win group stage game. She worked as a bank clerk as well as being an England cricketer, because obviously at that time it was still an entirely kind of amateur game, although they were training very hard and they did, you know, they were very competitive, but it was amateur in the sense of they were all unpaid. And so she was working full time as a bank clerk while also hitting centuries against Australia.
And tell me, did you feel any qualms about allowing those documents to go to Lord's, given the poor record of the MCC with women's cricket? We'll come on to that. Did you feel that it was necessarily the right place, given how the institutional obstacles presented to women's cricket by the MCC establishment?
What a fantastic question, Peter. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before.
I tell you why I asked it, because I wrote my book on Basil de Oliveira, and as a result found myself in possession of certain very important documents, which I wondered what to do with. I certainly didn't think they belonged to me in any, you know what I mean, in any financial sense. So I wanted to go to the right place, and I couldn't have given them to Lord's because of the appalling behaviour of the MCC.
You're absolutely right that they have a really terrible track record when it comes to women's cricket. And I have to say that that has persisted until really relatively recently. Certainly, I remember going into the MTC library at the start of my PhD, because everyone, all the sports historians I spoke to said, you must go to the MTC. You know, they're the people who have all the cricket stuff. And I went in and I said, what do you have on women's cricket? And they pointed me to this section of the bookshelves in the library. And I think there was maybe two books there. And obviously, you know, they've got hundreds and thousands of books and all of this, you know, they do also have this archive, and they just really had almost nothing on women's cricket. And people like, for example, Enid Bakewell, very famous former England cricketer who listeners may well have heard of, apparently had offered lots of her stuff to MCC when she retired and had said, you know, oh, would you like my England blazer? Would you like some of my bats? Would you like this, that and the other? And they'd said, oh, no, we're not interested in women's cricket. We're not interested in taking that stuff.
Can you say what year that was, Ralph?
She retired, I think it would have been 1982 that she retired, so this might have, but I think that certainly there was stuff being offered to them in the 90s and even the early noughties that they were turning down. And I have come across examples of because obviously what happens when you know, a kind of very prolific female cricketer dies is that she tended to have kind of acquired all this material, and sometimes the family weren't quite sure what to do with it, and they might then you know, potentially have offered it to Lords, and Lords would have said no, not really very interested. And you do hear about things just being chucked out that would have been of such immense historical worth. And it's so frustrating as a historian to hear about some of this. So while there have been these records that were preserved, there has also been some stuff that's been lost. So I suppose, yeah, in response to the question, mixed feelings about the MCC acquiring this material. I do still feel that the MCC has a long way to go in terms of its attitudes to women's cricket. On the other hand, I feel that perhaps this is the start of kind of women's cricket reclaiming its rightful space at Lord's, which ultimately is the kind of symbolic home of cricket. And if we don't want it to remain just as the symbolic home of men's cricket, then perhaps we do need to start pushing our way in and saying, hello, you know, we've got this great stuff and women's cricket is just as important. And so we're going to occupy some actual physical space within the archive. There's a kind of a sort of symbolic importance of that.
Very much so. Ralph, push back on that, would the MCC and the authorities say, well, look, people are really fundamentally only interested in men's cricket, and you know, they don't watch women's cricket until recently. Why should they be interested in matches which and records of what essentially is amateur club cricket? We don't keep records of many records of men's club cricket. Why should we keep them for women's? I suppose that's what they might argue. Or have you encountered that sort of argument?
It would be deeply ironic of the MCC, a kind of amateur members club, to be objecting to keeping records of amateur women's club cricket, I suppose. It certainly is an argument that that has been put forward. And I think that to some extent, people wouldn't necessarily say that publicly now, but they might well think that. They might well think that there is less interest in women's cricket and that therefore it's not as important and that we shouldn't be kind of giving it equal consideration. I mean, I obviously have built my career around objecting to that view and very much kind of forcefully pushing back against that view. And I think that one of the reasons why it's so important that we acknowledge the history of women's cricket is that so many of these things that you talk about in terms of there being less people watching or, you know, a less high standard is about historical underinvestment. And that's why knowing and understanding the history is so important. So, you know, we've only had professional contracts for the England women's team since 2014. Men's cricket has been professional for decades. And so therefore you just can't look at them and compare them on an equal footing. If you look at men's versus women's county cricket, men's county cricket has been entirely professional for a very long time. Women's county cricket is still an entirely amateur undertaking that the ECB are now saying is a kind of recreational thing. But does that mean that it doesn't matter? Well, of course it matters. And you know, in a way, women's cricket is the biggest kind of growth area, potential growth area for cricket, really. If you think about the amount of girls and women who might want to be playing cricket and haven't had that opportunity, then I think that it's almost the future for cricket. So that's the argument to make if somebody tries to come along and say none of this is very important.
Well, it is. And it's also a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? If you say for decades and centuries that something isn't important, then it does indeed not become important in the public mind, and it loses its following. Ralph, your book has restored the importance and the salience of women's cricket, and it's full of revelations. One of them, very first one to me, is the fact that there's an image of a woman playing cricket from 1344, which must be one of the earliest images of any form of cricket anywhere. This image seems to be a bit of a mystery. It's in the Bodleian Library, but it's not exhibited, is that right? And I wondered if you'd actually seen it.
I haven't seen the original image, but I have seen reproductions of it, and it is a really interesting, striking image. It looks to be a kind of almost some nuns and some monks kind of playing cricket together, which is quite striking because generally we don't think of men and women playing cricket together very much, especially in that early period, perhaps. So you've kind of got the nun sort of holding what looks to be cricket ball and the monk holding something which could be a cricket bat, and he's certainly got a very high back lift, so a very modern monk there.
Modern monk. How about the woman? Is she bowling? She got a good action?
She's not really bowling in the sense that we would recognise it today. She is simply holding the ball and looks almost like a kind of a prototype of cricket, although some historians would say it's not really cricket per se, it's just a kind of bat and ball game.
Well, overarm bowling wasn't introduced, and we'll come on to that because there's a big theory it was introduced by women, not men, until the late 19th century. So it'd be very...
1864.
Yes, it would be very... what's the phrase used by historians? Unreal if she was actually bowling in the way we think of it today. But wow, what a fact! When King Edward III was on the throne, it was 2 years before the Battle of Crecy, 4 years before the Black Death, and they were already playing cricket. And so your book says there's a gap of 400 years thereafter to the next mention. Tell us about that, Raph. Why a gap of 400 years to the next mention you can find?
I think it's partly just about what we have records for in terms of the gap. I don't think that there's necessarily an explanation other than, it's probably something that prevails in the men's game as well, in the sense of it's about what we have records for and what we might recognise as kind of specifically sort of resembling modern cricket. The first recorded women's match after that 1344 nun is 1745. It's a report from the Reading Mercury describing these two villages of women playing cricket against each other, and they wear different coloured hair ribbons to distinguish them between the two sides.
That's mind-blowing, actually, that there was women's village cricket, two women's teams playing each other in the 18th century. It was, of course, a period of... 18th century was a period of opening up, wasn't it? It was after the Puritans and before the Victorians, and it was somehow much looser in a way. It was much less prejudiced. Is that a fair comment about the 18th century?
Yeah, I think it probably is fair in terms of cricket. Certainly in some of these early instances of women's village matches, you do see some really interesting phenomena. You see kind of sometimes there being quite a lot of interest in terms of crowds. You see people betting on these matches. Gosh. There was quite a lot of gambling on these early women's matches. So there's kind of commercial interest, and sometimes there's prizes available, people getting given ale if they do well, or if their team wins and things like that. So there's definitely some real interest in those village women's matches. And then I think that the Victorian era kind of cracks down on it to some extent because of their much more conservative attitude to the role of women.
And what sort of women were they? Because in recent years, what we're familiar with is we think of women as women's cricket in the 20th century as a sort of upper middle class game in a way. But what about in the 18th century?
We don't know a huge amount about the particular women that were playing, and it's something that is quite difficult to research. But I think that one of the interesting things is that it looks like some of them were married, because sometimes you get these matches between married women and unmarried women, for example. And that's something that in terms of married women playing, the Victorians and post-Victorians very much sort of cracked down on because of this disapproval and this feeling that married women should be devoting themselves to their husbands. But some of what we know of that that late 18th century phenomena of women playing village cricket, there were married women playing.
And were there mixed teams, i.e. women as we get now in village cricket, which is such a lovely and quite new development, get women playing for village teams and club teams?
I think at that time it still tended to be mainly teams of exclusively women playing other women's teams, and then men's village cricket tended to be only men. So I think it did tend to still be split men versus women at that point.
And I'm delighted to read that the Duke of Dorset, who was such a great figure, the man who had a cricket team visiting Paris during the French, as the French Revolution kicked off, he was a great sponsor.
Yeah, they did have support from some quite high-profile aristocratic men. There was also some opposition and some, we do see some images that have endured from that period that are almost kind of trying to undermine women playing cricket and suggesting we shouldn't take it seriously. But there were, as you say, high-profile supporters like the Duke of Dorset, yes.
You quote a wonderful passage of encouragement he gives to women cricketers in your book. Begins, "What is human life but a game of cricket? And if so, why should not the ladies play it as well as we?" And then there's a long, what we'd call in the speech-making business, a long exordium about, why women are just as capable of, are not too delicate to play cricket. It's a splendid passage, that one. But you then, as we've said, Ralph, cricket then gets, for women, then gets caught up in Victorian ideals of womanhood and the role of womanhood. But it also gets hindered, doesn't it, by Victorian clothing. It's very much more difficult, physically difficult to play in Victorian clothing, particularly those long hooped skirts. And I wondered if you discovered any truth, authority in the legend that it's a woman who invents overarm bowling to get round the obstacle of the hoop skirt. The first overarm ball was delivered by Christina Wills, the sister of John, who was the first man to bowl an overarm ball.
Unfortunately, I haven't managed to discover whether that's true or not. There's certainly some suggestion that it might be a kind of slightly mythical story, which perhaps points to it more likely not being true than being true, unfortunately, which is a shame because it is such a wonderful evocative idea or picture of this, this woman just going, well, I'm fed up with my long skirt, so I'm just going to invent an entirely new style of bowling. And I know during my PhD, I was actually invited to attend a play that somebody had written. It was just a sort of quite a short, amusing 20-minute play. And it was all about this Christina Wiles inventing overarm bowling. And then in the course of the same over, she also invented spin bowling, swing bowling, bowling and reverse swing. With every successive delivery, she was adding something more to the to modern cricket as we know it. It was a wonderful play, very hilarious, but obviously complete nonsense in terms of historical accuracy. But the reason why it's such a great story and the reason why it's important is because, and I think it points to a fundamental truth, which is that so often women were contributing to cricket, to early cricket, kind of behind the scenes, and then didn't get the plaudits.
Yeah. I mean, W.G. Grace's mother is a big example, isn't she? She bowls and fields at all of her sons, including W.G. And then her payback is W.G. saying that cricket's unsuitable for women. As a lot of Victorian men did, he added rather spurious medical grounds for this too, didn't he?
He did. He said that it was unsuitable for ladies, and it's quite an interesting one because, as you say, his mum was somebody who had bowled at him and essentially kind of taught him some of the fundamentals of cricket. And also his two daughters played cricket at Clifton High School, which is one of these kind of 19th century schools that was quite progressive in terms of offering cricket for girl pupils. His daughters played and were apparently quite good at school. He ends up suggesting that women shouldn't be playing cricket, which I think is speaks to his character as perhaps, I mean, he's obviously a legend, but not necessarily somebody that you'd want to be friends with.
He had to play to because he was the first British sporting celebrity. He had to play, I guess, perhaps to his mass audience, which he depended on for money, apart from anything else.
Ralph, in the 19th century, girls' cricket benefits hugely, doesn't it, from the emergence of girls' public schools. And that's a running theme in your book, is whether and how girls get to play cricket in schools, isn't it?
It certainly is. And one reason why they're so important in that early period in the 19th century is because there isn't yet a national governing body of women's cricket. So there isn't a kind of central association that's setting up teams and helping kind of women organise matches. So that means that what's happening in these individual schools is so important. So you get schools like, for example, St Leonard's in Scotland, or Cheltenham Ladies College, or Rodine, who are all kind of pioneers in the sense of introducing girls' cricket for their pupils very early on. But once we get into the 20th century and we see an expansion of secondary education for all girls, for example, in the wake of the 1944 Education Act, which kind of does expand secondary education, there is a bit of a missed opportunity then, because girls' cricket has developed and is very strong in the private sector. It then kind of almost stymies it to some extent, because it doesn't become accessible to girls in the state sector. And that's been a recurring problem. And I suppose we do see that now for boys cricket as well. But it's perhaps been a bit of a more recent problem with the boys game, whereas with girls cricket, it's been kind of very much a running historical issue that actually, if you're middle class and you're well off and you can go to a good cricketing school, then you access cricket early. But if you're an ordinary girl going to a normal state school, like I did, I didn't have cricketing opportunities.
Ralph, how much does cricket figure in girls' literature, girls' school literature? It figures greatly in boys' literature, and P.G. Woodhouse wrote the best of it. But how does, for example, Angela Brazel deal with cricket, or does she?
She does, yeah, I'm pretty sure she does. I think that she does include accounts of cricket matches, of girls' cricket matches. And actually, I was really struck the other day rereading some of my old Enid Blytons. I don't know if I should admit to that on the podcast, but rereading some of my old Enid Blytons, which are very well loved. Her one example of the progressive school, which is in a book called The Naughtiest Girl Goes to School, or the Naughtiest Girl series anyway. And it's a kind of progressive co-educational school. And in that, in the first book, when Elizabeth arrives at school, she's immediately told, oh, we always play the boys at cricket and we always beat them. And Enid Blyton never kind of includes an account of a cricket match in those books, unfortunately. But I just thought that was really interesting because she is seen as not a particularly progressive writer, shall we say, but she included that reference in that book. And, you know, therefore it shows that to some extent kind of girls cricket had penetrated her world and the way that she thought about girls boarding schools.
Yeah, my mum, at this point I should reveal, was captain of St Swithin's in about 1940s, I suppose, where she was coached, she informs me, by Leary Constantine, the great, I mean, the West Indian great club player in Lancashire leagues, and then he, of course, a sensational player in those early West Indian teams in the 30s, wasn't he? That's
right. Yes. Yep.
Anyway, coached my mum. She remembers it vividly to this day, and she was quite a successful player for St Swithin's.
Would be the other great nursery, wasn't it, of women's cricket in the Victorian age is country houses, isn't it? And you get these, a lot of teams, which doesn't help the game spread socially, does it? Because these are all private and very elite teams, but they do play a lot of cricket. And I think their most celebrated women cricketer, the most celebrated club is the White Heather Club, and their most celebrated performer is the future Mrs. Stanley Baldwin, isn't she? Lucy Ridsdale.
Yeah, absolutely. She's described as being a demon fit bowler. She was also a batter as well, so a distinguished all-rounder. Joined the White Heather Club in 1890 when she was aged 21, and remained a member for decades. There's this great story about kind of Stanley Baldwin coming to watch her play cricket and sort of seeing her play and kind of falling in love with her on the spot. And she later apparently tells Australian captain Herbie Collins, who she met during the 1926 Ashes tour when Stanley had gone on and they got married and he'd become prime minister. And she said to him, "Oh, I was frightfully nervous when I went into bat, but when I became engaged to Mr. Baldwin, I lost all my nervousness. And the year that I was married, I made my best batting average, which was 62 for the season." So the marriage obviously benefited her in cricketing terms as well as in kind of emotional ones.
Well, there's some stories in your book of women who encounter difficulties with cricket when they get married, and practical ones. But so it's nice to think that Lucy Baldwin actually benefited, actually her play actually improved, being married to Stanley Baldwin, who was very... I can't imagine Baldwin himself as a cricketer. He was a very, a somnolent figure. So I think she was a dynamic member of the partnership. He did become president of the MCC later, as Earl Baldwin of Bewdley, after he'd retired. So he did love cricket.
Talk about the connection, or if there is one, between the suffragette movement, which emerges before World War One, and cricket.
Well, the biggest, most important figure who kind of crosses both those worlds between the suffrage movement and women's cricket is Frances Heron Maxwell. So she ended up going on to become one of the founding members of the Women's Cricket Association, which was the first governing body for women's cricket in England. And that's founded in 1926. Mm. But kind of earlier in her life, she'd been a kind of prominent member of the Liberal Party. And she co-founds the Liberal Women Suffrage Society in 1913. So she's very politically involved, actually. And there's another nice connection. The first ever England women's captain, Betty Archdale. So the first international women's cricket happens in 1934-35 when an England team travelled to Australia and New Zealand, and Betty Archdale is made the captain. But earlier on in her life, her mother had been an active suffrage campaigner, and Betty had gathered stones for her to throw into the at the windows of these political buildings and kind of smashed the windows. So she'd had that kind of early political upbringing, if you like.
There's a tremendous novel about the links between cricket and the suffragette movement called Half the Human Race by Anthony Quinn, which I really recommend. It's got great authentic detail about both cricket.
One of the things you we'll get to know, if you get to know Richard better, Raph, is there's nothing he doesn't know. There's no novel he hasn't actually read and can talk about in great detail. Tell us about this book. There's a book about cricket and suffragettes, Richard.
There's a very fine novel about the relationship between a county cricketer and a suffragette. It's the central theme of the book. There's a tremendous scene which I think Ralph would relate to from her book. Right at the beginning, they meet, and she's watching him play cricket in a county match, and she understands cricket herself, and she explains, you know, certain technical weaknesses in his game, why he's not why he's getting out, and he's amazed and rather angry that a woman should be able to analyse his play as a county cricketer. But their relationship develops. I don't want to do a spoiler on it. It's a very fine novel about that period in cricket and the women's movement.
I'm ashamed to say I don't even know who Anthony Quinn was.
He's not the film actor. He was the film critic of The Independent, and he's written other novels as well. I think he's a full-time. Glad to say, I think he's able to afford being a full-time novelist now, unlike some of us. Ralph, one of the themes running right through your book is this sort of amateur ethos of women's cricket, which lasts for a very, very long time, and indeed it's still, as I think you said a moment ago, it's still in force in women's county cricket. It seems that the women actually positively, those administering women's cricket, really insisted on this sort of amateur ethos, even when opportunities presented themselves for a more professional or a more commercial approach.
Yes, certainly the Women's Cricket Association are really strong and really kind of insist that amateurism is written into the first constitution of the WCA, which I think is published in 1930. And actually there is a rule in that says that only amateurs can become members of the association. And I think that this is partly about a need to kind of almost feel that they will be accepted by the MCC, by the kind of existing men's cricketing establishment. They're not trying to, they're not actually trying to do something that will cause ructions. They're trying to fit in with what's already kind of happening. And they're trying to make sure that they can continue doing that or continue playing cricket without necessarily kind of making waves. So I think that they feel that the best way to achieve this is to accept the MCC's kind of ideology of amateurism and the MCC's kind of social conservatism. And that's why you see this embrace of amateurism. And certainly there is a competing organisation in the 1930s. So there are some Northern women's cricket the federations in Lancashire and Yorkshire that set themselves up as kind of rivals to the WCA, which is very much based in the south of England. And they are, for example, because many of the women who are playing in those leagues are working women. So therefore they have to get have an agreement with their employers to go off and play. So they kind of get time in lieu, or sometimes a collection is taken for those women. So amateurism isn't something that's necessarily uniformly adopted across all of women's cricket. But the WCA is the sort of biggest mover and shaker in the 1920s and 1930s. And then gradually women's Northern League cricket sort of dies a bit of a death during the Second World War, and the WCA becomes the dominant organisation, and that then insists on kind of reintroducing and reinforcing amateurism after the war. And then that kind of persists for decades, really.
Very reminiscent. Richard and I have done a lot of work about women's cricket in Pakistan, where it begins in Karachi, the organisation of it, and then, of course, Lahore, which is more socially acceptable in a way, grander socially, although less vibrant also commercially, many people would say. They're still ongoing, I think. It's still a huge legal clashes, aren't there, Richard, between the...
There was a great rivalry between to women's organisations in Pakistan. There is legal action, but legal action which began, I think, in the 2000s, and some of it's still in progress today because the Pakistan legal system, well, does...
John Dice versus John Dice.
It does, yeah. It does have some of that character, but or can do. But picking up what you said, Ralph, women's cricket is terribly dependent on male goodwill, isn't it? And to some extent still is. For long periods, they depend on the goodwill of men, even to get, even for quite basic things like getting grounds, don't they, and equipment, and the umpire, and, you know, most umpires are men, and most scorers are men. So one can understand. They not only, we can understand women accommodating themselves to, you know, the male power structure, and it extends, doesn't it, even to the extent of, you know, dress and deportment and behaviours, and women sort of force themselves to conform to, you know, a male ideal of what women should look like in sport, don't they?
Absolutely. You particularly highlighted dress there. There's a very strict WCA dress code. Initially, it's all about kind of skirts being a certain number of inches from the floor when kneeling. And that's, so they're very strict about that. Marjorie Pollard, who's another one of the founders of the WCA, actually says, you know, I never want to see women playing cricket in trousers. She says that trousers are beyond the pale. So that's a quote from her. And so she's got very set, rigid ideas about what women should be wearing when they play cricket. And that is partly about kind of, they're trying to, as one of my interviewees described it, we were trying to look like women in a man's world. So there's a sort of element of conforming to conservative ideas about womanhood, but there's also perhaps an element of a point of difference between women's and men's cricket. If we play cricket in skirts, then we won't look like men, so we won't be seen to be trying to copy the men. I'd like to take you up on a point that you just made about umpires, though, that there are actually, or there certainly were, a great deal of female umpires trained by the WCA. So when the Women's Cricket Association first formed in 1926, of course, initially they are quite reliant on male umpires because of there aren't very many women who have kind of, you know, done training as an umpire. But one of the things that they quickly try to do is to actually introduce particular kind of courses where they can train more female umpires. And certainly in international women's cricket in England, it was all umpired by women right up until the 1990s, every single match. So, for example, if you look at the 1973 First Cricket World Cup, all of the umpires, I think all of the umpires are women. So actually it's very much something that they're aware of and that they're trying to do something about. But they can't do anything about the fact that that all of the cricket grounds in England are owned by men. So that is something where they are, as you say, very reliant on the goodwill of men to say, yes, you can use our ground, or in the case of the MCC, no, you can't use Lord's until 1976. And even then you can only use it, you know, once every decade. So very, very generous of them. But yeah, so that is an ongoing problem. So that's one of the advantages of Heron Maxwell, is that she owns this estate with her husband, Great Comp in Kent. And actually what they do is they mark out a specific cricket ground on their estate. And that is where a lot of the early women's matches are played. And that's an example of a ground that's kind of made and created and owned by women. But it's very much a single example.
Returning to the Women's Cricket Association, which is obviously such an important moment in 1926, the year of the general strike when it gets founded. Why did it take so long to happen?
It's a really great question. I think that there are some suggestions pre-First World War that there might be an opportunity to set up a national association. But it's felt, I think, that there aren't necessarily enough players for that to be something that's viable at that point. And I think that what tended to happen was that you had these kind of little local hotspots of women's cricket, which, for example, in some of these girls' schools, they might have very strong teams, but you didn't necessarily have that kind of national impetus from above.
And talk a little bit about these two extraordinary women, both of whom, as part of the recognition of women's cricket, have been retrospectively acknowledged in the Wisden obituaries, Marjorie Pollard and Heron Maxwell.
I love the Wisden feature. I think it's called The Women Wisden Forgot. And yeah, it's all about recognising women who should have had a bigger obituary at the time, who were really important in women's cricket. So Frances Jane Heron Maxwell, who we've talked about a little bit, was a sort of very seasoned campaigner for women's rights at the time that she helped found and then became the first chair of the Women's Cricket Association. She'd been involved in organisations like the Rational Dress League, which was aiming to promote sort of more practical and comfortable clothing for women. We said that she co-founded the Liberal Women's Suffrage Society in 1913. She was also, she'd been president of the All England Women's Hockey Association. And during the First World War, she'd been one of the big organisers of the Women's Land Army, which was trying to kind of grow food for the population while the men were away fighting at the front. So by the time she became WCA chair, she'd been already been awarded an MBE in 1918. And then, as I said, she goes on and creates this cricket ground on her estate. So that's Frances Heron Maxwell, amazing woman, really. Marjorie Pollard, I think I've kind of hinted at the fact that she maybe wasn't necessarily universally popular with other female cricketers because she was very strict and conservative in some of her views. Goes on, her biggest contribution to women's cricket is probably as a writer and journalist. She writes about the women's game for a lot of national newspapers, especially in the 1930s. And she becomes the first ever sports commentator, female sports commentator on the BBC.
What does she comment on when she comes in the 30s? That's very early days of any kind of sporting commentary, isn't it?
It is very early days. So it's the first ever women's cricket internationals in England. They take place in 1937. Australia comes and plays in three tests here. So she becomes one of the commentators. And then after the Second World War, in 1951, the first ever televised women's cricket match, England v Australia at the Oval. She ends up commentating on that. So she's kind of a very early TV female commentator as well. But yeah, as I said, she was very conservative, and in the 1930s, she set up and ran a magazine called Women's Cricket Magazine, it sold quite well actually, and it was all of the WCA news. But it was also available for the public to buy, so it really helped kind of generate a bit of sort of noise and publicity around the women's game. And there's a great section in that where she talks about turning up at a game and she hears two women saying, watch yourself, Pollard's here, or something like that. So that gives you an indication of how she was viewed, perhaps. But she was certainly a very pioneering, forceful, determined lady.
Is there a crossover between these two magnificent figures and the early organisers of the game and the Women's Institute, which really gets going in that period?
Heron Maxwell did serve on the committee of the National Federation of Women's Institutes for a time. But in terms of crossover between the two organisations, I think that's as far as it goes. But there were certainly WI sides playing women's cricket in the 1930s.
A recurring theme in your book, Ralph, and it lasts for a long time, is how difficult it is for married women to play cricket in England and to stay involved in cricket. And all those early tours you mentioned are all carried out by unmarried women, usually from quite well-to-do and with supportive families. And this theme lasts really for a very long time, doesn't it?
You're right. I think that a lot of it comes down to societal expectations about the role of women. And particularly, there's this idea that once women are married, they don't really have any entitlement to leisure time. Often they're kind of expected to just sort of service the leisure of their husbands and children. And that is a really big issue. And of course, cricket is quite time consuming. And I think that obviously we do talk about kind of cricket widows and men going off and leaving their wives and their children for kind of, you know, whole weekends at a time, basically to go and play cricket. And, you know, that's much less common now, thankfully, from the female perspective. But yeah, you do have to have a supportive husband. Somebody like Enid Bakewell, for example, who's going off on cricket tours in the 1960s and 1970s is actually, you know, very much in our interview talked about the difficulties of leaving her young children with her husband and that being, you know, creating some tensions there actually. And certainly, yes, on the earliest women's tours. So, for example, the 1934-35 tour, when England go to Australia and New Zealand, none of those women are married. Although there is an interesting story about the fact that the manager of that tour, Betty Green, met her future husband on the boat out to Australia. She went on to marry. He was the ship's first officer, I think. So there was a kind of cricketing opportunity there to meet her future husband, which is quite a nice story.
Mm. Raf, we've only got up to the 1930s, really, with a couple of leaps ahead into the future. Perhaps you could tell us, though, a little bit about yourself as a cricketer.
I wish that there was more to tell. I think probably my biggest cricketing claim to fame is that I've played cricket with Vince Cable. I once played for a local Liberal Democrat side on Twickenham Green and Vince took a couple of wickets, although my dad took three wickets, so my dad is a better bowler than Vince Cable. But myself, I'm not really very much of a cricketer. I played a lot of beach cricket when I was young, and my love of cricket absolutely comes from my dad, who is just who has been watching cricket since probably the 50s or the 60s is very much kind of somebody I would describe as a walking wisdom. So that's where it's come from. But in terms of me playing cricket, other than beach cricket, I didn't really play properly until I got to university and then played a little bit as an undergrad. And these days I'm probably during the cricket season too busy kind of running around and writing about other matches to actually play very much, unfortunately.
Yeah, Vince Cable's a very well-rounded character. I'm not surprised. I'm delighted to learn.
He's a very good ballroom dancer. So he should, have very good footwork as a batsman.
Anyway, look, Raf, I want to ask you, would you come back? Because we really need to take on this lovely, very enriching, fascinating story, which is as much about British social history as it is about cricket. Would you come back and play a second innings, but from World War II onwards, really?
Of course, I'd love to come back.
It'd be wonderful if you could.
On which happy note, I really should say goodbye from Southeast London, which for the moment is pleasantly sunny.
Oh, you wait, Richard. It's already clouding over here in Wiltshire. It's goodbye from me, Peter Oborne.